It's Wednesday, April 3rd, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behavior comes to you from the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean. Here with me are Views regulars and Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. On our program this week, the Rutgers University basketball coach caught on camera abusing his players gets the boot. CBS shows restraint when player Kevin Ware suffers a horrible injury during the network's March Madness broadcast of the Duke-Louisville game last Sunday. The Associated Press does an about-face on its stylebook policy regarding use of the phrase illegal immigrant. And critics skewer the New York Times for topping its obituary of a famous rocket scientist with a reference to her cooking skills. Well, our show has featured its share of sports stories over the past several months, from the Jerry Sandusky interview to Michael Dixon's departure to Fox's plans for a new cable network. Well, now add to that list today's breaking news that Rutgers University has fired basketball coach Mike Rice. The apparent reason, intense pressure on the school following ESPN's airing of videotapes that show Rice pushing, kicking, and throwing balls at his players during practice. Rice also verbally abused them, using the F-bomb, other profanities, and gay slurs. WABC-TV caught up with Rice this morning outside his New Jersey home.
Can't say anything right now except I'm sorry, and there will never be a time where I'm going to use any of that as an excuse. Will there be any excuse? I've let so many people down. My players, my administration, Rutgers University, the fans, my family who's sitting in their house just huddled around because of the fact that their father was an embarrassment to them.
Charles, I have to say the details are obviously different, but the way Rutgers president and their athletic director handled this Rice affair seems to have a lot in common with the way MU dealt with the allegations against Michael Dixon last year, those sexual abuse allegations. At Rutgers, they had the tape of Rice back in November, and they opted to suspend him for a few days, then fine him, make him attend some anger management classes, and then ESPN got a hold of the videos for its Outside the Lines program, and that's when the dominoes all fell.
Yeah, I mean, of course, several distinctions between Dixon. This is the coach of the team. The nature of the allegations, of course, one sexual violence, the other what, physical and verbal abuse.
Yeah.
I will say, as a guy who grew up playing a lot of ball in the Deep South, I had a few basketballs launched at my head, but not by the head coach of a public university. Usually by a zit-faced 14-year-old sadomasochist coach. It is completely indefensible, and I think the difference here between Rutgers' behavior when the light of day had not dawned on that video and their behavior after that video became a national story was, I mean, you could argue they were going to let that whole thing just go away with a little counseling, I think, had it not blown up.
And that was my point about the sort of the similarities, Lee, between that and the way MU handled Dixon. The athletic director, at least, and the coach appeared to know a lot about the allegations against Dixon. But until the news media, most especially the Columbia Tribune, you know, got wind of this, and the victim or one of the victims used Twitter to basically get out in the media and describe what had happened to her, they weren't handling the Dixon affair with the level of, I guess, attention that they should have.
Both are examples of when details matter, because it's one thing to say that the coach threw a basketball at a player. It's another thing to say that the coach used foul language. It's yet another thing to see it for yourself so you can see what's going on. And I think similarly, the details of the alleged Michael Dixon assault, those details were quite telling. The larger lesson here for all of us, and I've spent a fair amount of time the last couple of weeks thinking about social media in the lives of young people and what that really means. is that you're never off camera. People need to begin to figure that out in real time for themselves. And in some ways, that's very sad.
I have to say, too, Charles, obviously we should give kudos to ESPN, but oftentimes we criticize them for the cozy deals they have and the financial relationships they have with, say, college sports and professional sports. But in this instance, their investigative sports program, Outside the Lines, which does a lot of good work, finds a whistleblower. A whistleblower goes to them, probably because of the quality of work they've done. And this whistleblower was a former NBA player. He was a personnel development on the team. And he's the one who brought the allegations to ESPN, and apparently the university fired him for doing so.
Yeah, well, he says he was fired for whistleblowing. The university says he was incompetent before he ever blew the whistle.
What do you think was the
reason? Who knows? Well, right now I think Rutgers has very little institutional validity when they make arguments. I'd say that. It's also a telling statement, I think, in many of these episodes, that once the news media does its job, it gets actually a lot easier for institutions to do the right thing. And maybe it's easier because it is out there. And instead of spending every waking minute thinking about how they can keep it from getting out there, once it's already in the court of public opinion, pardon the pun, then you see justice dispensed in the way I would argue it should have been dispensed a year ago to this individual. Right. This was not a to me, this is not one where you sit around head scratching. This guy's fired by nightfall. And that it took this long and actually took the video for somebody to do the right thing. It's just a lot easier to do the right thing when everybody's watching.
Well, there was another sports story this week that shone a spotlight on journalistic practices. If you didn't see it live on television, you almost surely read about it on social or traditional media. We're talking, of course, about that awful sight of Louisville's Kevin Ware breaking his leg while trying to contest a shot in last Sunday's NCAA tournament win over Duke. CBS had the live broadcast. Here's how Newsy.com summarized the reaction from critics.
CBS aired two replays of the fall in slow motion, then stopped. The network did not show a close-up. Color analyst Clark Kellogg said there was no reference point here. Totally uncharted territory for everybody in the building, for players, for us. USA Today said the network handled coverage with restraint, pointing out the power of images of Ware's teammates and fans in the stands, that their reactions were enough to convey the story. And Sports Illustrated says CBS struck the right balance of staying with the story from afar. CBS cameras followed Ware being removed from the arena and did so with proper distance. The network opted smartly to stay with the scene rather than go to commercial.
Well, so we heard what some others had to say about the way CBS handled it. Lee, I'm curious to hear what you thought about how they handled it. I mean, there was a lot of silence, only a couple of replays. They decided later not to show those replays again. The right call?
I think very much the right call, and partly because I'm sure there were a number of people like me. I saw it live and didn't really realize what was happening because the camera was far away. And so you could see sort of the horror-struck expression of the people around, but not necessarily what was causing it. ESPN and CBS and lots of folks are beginning to have, unfortunately, too much experience covering people becoming badly injured playing whatever it is that they're playing. And so I would hope that some of that over time is actually beginning to say, you know, we don't need to invade this person's privacy. We don't need to show the pain. We can show the impact of the event by showing what others are doing. Let's cover it as if it's news. Let's not encourage our viewers to be voyeurs.
Well, in CBS, this is the second major sporting event in a few months. Charles, we go back to the Super Bowl and the lights going out in the stadium, and they clearly were not prepared for that. I don't know if you can ever be prepared for a young man breaking his leg as badly as this happened either, but it seemed to me the way they handled it, it was kind of raw but restrained. Clark Kellogg kind of took on the duties as a former player of, you know, trying to be very sympathetic, lots of silence, just letting us see the video of how the players and coaches were and the fans were reacting. I don't know if you could plan for it, but I thought they did a better job this time.
I thought it was highly professionally done and in really trying. I mean, people have to remember how trying the circumstances are. This is live television. You've got producers in your ear. There were probably 10 different arguments being made simultaneously. And they listened, I think, to their inner voice, which said, just be quiet. Let the moment speak for itself. And the cameramen were respectful. and remained at a distance. I think it was a very proud moment for CBS Sports. I think other, particularly online media, followed in ways that are incredibly regrettable. Yahoo Sports created a GIF file, if you know what a GIF is, just an ever-repeating loop of video, and put it on the front of Yahoo Sports within about 15 minutes. I wasn't watching live, but I did have a laptop in my lap at that moment, and I was on Twitter. So I started to see Twitter blow up at that moment with references. So I went and kind of surfed around. And lo and behold, a really interesting thing, and this is a great part of sort of social networks and media criticism. A Yahoo Sports reporter tweeted, "Yeah, we just did a GIF of the accident. Classy." He criticized his own media organization on Twitter. And I don't know if that resulted in it being taken down, but it was ultimately taken down.
There were some folks, Lee, who argued with a straight face in criticizing CBS that they actually should have shown it more, claiming it's not our job to babysit, that people ought to be able to see something as important as the images around a story like this.
Okay, that one doesn't work with me at all. I mean, I've been to enough live sporting events, so the two that I remember best were when my daughter was quite young, my husband and I had taken her up to Cheyenne for Cheyenne Frontier Days. We were watching her first rodeo when one of the bull riders got gored to death by a bull. Sorry, don't need to go and revisit that one. I was also at the game of Colorado versus Oregon a number of years ago where one of the players in a normal tackle was paralyzed. Don't need to revisit that one either. I mean, there's just a certain level of, I guess, human kindness that over and over again, I think we kind of learn from this stuff.
Well, regardless, if you want to go, it's easy enough if you've got an internet browser to find footage of whatever.
So don't.
I have to say, though, I think we can sit back and one remove as journalists and say, you know, this was the right thing to do. But on the other hand, when we brought it up in class on Monday, some students brought it to our attention to discuss. I said, okay, how many of you saw the video? How many of you went looking for the video online? Most people said they did. And we sat around at the beginning of the class, show the video, show the video. So there's this rubbernecking, voyeuristic mentality that's out there. Hey, does the audience have some, you know, responsibility here?
Joe Theismann said he went and looked it up, right? I mean, Everybody said after this is the modern equivalent of Joe Theismann, who broke his leg horrifically on a Monday Night Football game, what, 20 years ago? And he wrote a little column saying, you know, I went and looked because I wanted to see if it was similar to my own injury. There's a big difference, though, between what your class was saying. They went and looked it up. It's not a peculiarly invasive media showing on television where people can't really hit the stop button. Well, they can nowadays if they've got DirecTV, but you know what I mean.
Right.
They're going to be people who just walk into a room and go, huh, and see it and had no desire to see it.
The other thing is that sometimes ethics is what you don't see. And so, for example, CBS didn't go in for the close-up. They had the technological ability to do that. That was not seeing. That was restraint, and that, too, was appropriate.
And I think ESPN also showed great restraint because they had access to the video after the fact when CBS was giving the rights to people to use it, and they chose not to use it either. Let's focus on another story. The Associated Press made a change this week to its style book. They announced yesterday – well, and the style book, by the way, for those who don't know, is the guide that many newspapers and other media use to determine what language to use and how they tell stories. Well, just a few months ago, after saying that it would stick with its policy of allowing the use of the term illegal immigrants to describe people who've moved here to the U.S. illegally, the AP changed its mind. Well, why did they do that? Lee, according to the vice president, Kathleen Carroll, she says the wire service wanted to reduce the use of labels that describe people rather than behaviors. So what is acceptable under their new guidelines? Quote, living in or entering a country illegally or without legal permission. So, well, that's certainly more wordy, if not inelegant. Does the change make sense to you?
I think this change is not the last one we're going to see over this term. If you listen and if you read, you can see phrases like undocumented workers instead of illegal aliens. There are interest groups that prefer one term over another. In some ways, you can tell somebody's politics by the label that they put on this. And the AP really tries hard to avoid that sort of thing. We have students, we have a couple of students who've done theses and dissertations about significant changes in AP style. So, for example, how we used to refer to ethnicity, that has changed in the last 50 years. How we refer to groups like Al-Qaeda, that has changed in the last 50 years. I suspect we'll have another sort of change about gay and lesbian people. So, I mean, there are lots of these kinds of things that go on. The important thing about it is that when AP does it, pretty much everybody else will fall in line. And their sense is that over time, the discourse will change.
And in fact, Charles, at the New York Times, although they are not falling in line with the AP's policy at the moment, they did say they were considering changing it, not to make an outright ban on the use of the word illegal immigrant, but to give their reporters and editors more leeway to use other options. Is that a good way to kind of split the baby?
I actually think it is, because as Lee said, language will evolve over time to reflect the realities. I mean, what the AP is trying to do is get out of the political business when it comes to the terminology of immigration. And both the proponents of and the opponents of illegal immigration or immigration period use that to their advantage. And what they're trying to do is sort of rob them of that by coming up with a more neutral descriptor. I agree with you, Lee. I don't think ultimately they've arrived at their destination. Yeah. Just the journalist in me cringes when we add words. And both of those descriptors add significant numbers of words to what right now is a two-word descriptor.
And whether you agree with the politics of it or not, Lee, I thought that the media critic over at the National Review had an interesting take on this, suggesting that it was somewhat Orwellian and said sort of tongue-in-cheek, well, then why don't we ban words like thief and instead describe people as engaged in thievery? I mean, how you can take this to absurd extremes.
You can take it to absurd extremes, but to sort of build on what Charles was talking, we use the phrase illegal immigrant to apply to adults who cross the border from whatever country illegally, and to two-year-olds they bring with them. These are children who are way, 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 way below the age of consent. So when Charles says that journalists need more latitude, we really do, because that one label does not accurately fit everybody. And if we're not in the business of anything else, we should be in the business of trying to say it accurately. On the other hand, because there's always an on the other hand. In this one, you know, when you are – the industry and politics have come up with really loathsome euphemisms for describing things that, if we were just a little bit more blunt about it, might truly be more meaningful. And the AP has got to thread its way through that, but so do the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of questionable wording, the New York Times came in for its share of abuse this week over its obituary for the famed rocket scientist Yvonne Brill. Now, over her life, Brill has been honored by NASA, the National Inventors Hall of Fame. She got an award from President Obama a couple of years ago. But the Times began her life story this way. Quote, she made a mean beef stroganoff, followed her husband from job to job, and took 8 years off from work to raise three children. Sexist? Many readers certainly thought it was, Charles.
I don't know if anybody was editing on the Times obit desk, or if anyone female was editing on the Times obit desk, because this is clearly an incident of just rampant stupidity. And I read the obit in its totality and tried to figure out what the writer was doing. And my theory, and it's just a crackpot theory, is that they were really coming up with this sort of postmodernist, I am woman, let me roar sort of take on it by saying she fed all of these traditional, stereotypical views of women, but she was a rocket scientist. Well, that doesn't quite work. I mean, I get where the attempt might have been noble, but the execution was deeply flawed.
Lee, were you surprised to see this deeply flawed approach in the New York Times of all places?
No, because the New York Times has a long and distinguished history that has been chronicled, among other places, in a couple of books about not doing particularly well by women or by its own women employees. So it doesn't surprise me that it happened at the Times. Unfortunately, it doesn't surprise me too much anyway. The interesting thing about it is the way that Charles said it, you know, I am woman, hear me roar, You know, Ginger Rogers did everything Fred Astaire did, only backwards in high heels. That would have been a much better opening than the, hi, let's just, you know, ladle on the beef stroganoff thing here.
Well, later in the day, the Times dropped the culinary reference after there was just so much, you know, negativity on the comments section and from other folks. They also made a few other language changes in the online version of the obituary. At least we have that option now, Charles.
Yeah, well, and you also, you know, it also made me wonder, the Times had a significant round of layoffs a couple of years ago, and one of the most significant parts of the paper was the obits desk, which lost at least three of the industry's most deeply respected obit writers, two of whom are women. And I'm wondering, I'd love to know, you know, the age and the experience of the obit writer who penned that gem.
Well, while we're talking about sexist language, let's also spend a minute contemplating a decision revealed last week by the BBC to give more prominent place to women as sources in news stories. Now, according to a piece in The Guardian and another one in The Telegraph, the BBC has set up a relatively small at the moment database of so-called expert women who've been trained by the network themselves on how to appear on camera to be more camera-friendly sources. They've also set up a YouTube channel with videos of some of these women who've been through the training that other people can watch. Well, Lee, first of all, how big a problem is it that we don't have enough women as expert sources, and how good a solution is the one described from the BBC?
Well, it's a big problem. And the irony here is, she said, making another pun, that this is the nation of Margaret Thatcher, probably the best expert of sources who also happens to be female. What the Beeb is doing would be fine if they would do it for men, too. It's, I mean, the way that it hit me when I was reading that, and I admit, you know, being a member of the female persuasion made me a bit sensitive, is that women need training on how to go on camera, but men don't?
Yeah.
I just, what is going on here?
It started with this proposition that the reason women aren't on camera more is because they're not good at it, not because producers don't select women to be on the air, which is the real root of the problem. Not that they fail in some way when they get on
camera. We've got these ancient Rolodexes or the digital equivalent of them, and we go to the same people over and over again. And for the most part, those are government officials, and they're not women typically.
Well, they're not women. And, I mean, this is not a problem that the Beeb has. It's a problem, I don't care what news organization you're looking at or how you content analyze it. When it comes to getting a variety of sources, we're terrible about any sort of gender equality, if you want to use that phrase. We don't do well with people of color. I mean, all you had to do was watch local coverage of the election last night, and I'm not knocking that coverage. People did a fine job. But if you go back and look at how many women were quoted as authoritative versus color commentary, I'm happy so-and-so won, we do it here locally as well. It's a really bad habit.
I also worry, Charles, if the bar at the BBC really is, well, you have to have this training and be, quote, good on camera to be a source, that's a pretty exclusive bunch, whether it's women or not. I mean, they had, I think they said, 60 people who've gone through the training and another 120 people who are in the database for a global news network, 120 or 180 women. I mean, at what point do they become the same old tired sources that we go to? Yeah. I mean, how diverse is that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can see, particularly on cable television, you can see how the think tanks in Washington, left and right, have rigged the game as far as who appears on camera, because they do groom and train. But not only that, they very actively lobby the networks to get these people on. Oh, I see you're talking about Afghanistan. Wouldn't you like General Wesley Clark, right? I mean, they literally have publicity agents touting these people as sources. And in a way, the BBC is going do it yourself on that. And I think, you know, at some level, it's laudable. If the goal is to try and get more women on camera as sources, that's laudable. But why not just go at it by saying we need more diverse sources, period, women among them? But certainly, I think they could go after ethnic diversity as well.
It's a place where television because it wants a polished performance. So we three here sit here every week and we have learned the hard way a little bit about something of that. But television, it's where the media matters more than what people are saying. And television is crafting these people so that they'll look good on TV, not because of what they will say or what the content of the message is. That there and TV more than some other mediums tends to do that. Although, again, that's a generalization and I can find many exceptions to it.
Well, I have to say, we talked about it, I think it was last week, from that new Pew Research Center report saying that basically TV is guilty now of just interview after interview after interview after boring interview of people on set rather than doing actual journalism, going out and reporting, and in that context, bringing in women or mine or anybody as sources into the stories. Well, finally this week, on a lighter note, we consider an interesting promotional campaign that's run by the folks over at Animal Planet. You know them. They're the cable channel that's part of the Discovery Networks family. If you go to APL.TV, you can watch live webcams of all sorts of cute critters, kittens, puppies, penguins, beluga whales, ants, even cockroaches. Well, right now, in fact, we're showing you, if you're watching our video stream, a shot from Animal Planet's live reef cam. I got to tell you, I mean, it's a webcam, you're looking at a bunch of fish swimming around. It doesn't sound all that interesting when described in audio, but according to a story in the New York Times, 25 million people have been watching these animal webcams since September of last year. On average, we look at these fish or penguins or kitties on an average of 20 minutes almost. And Lee, that's more than we watch some television shows.
It is more than we watch some television shows. The other thing I find about it is occasionally in the Academy, we talk about uses and gratifications that people actually come to a medium because they want something out of it. So when I'm having a particularly bad day, my daughter sends me Otter Cam. It is impossible to be anything other than happy and cheerful when watching an otter. You know, so I'm getting a little bit of mood change out of my television viewing, and I suspect I'm not the only one who's doing that.
It's like I dive into Duck Dynasty for the same thing, right? It's total escapism. It's like time to unplug from the world for a minute and watch something that, you know, either makes me laugh or makes me smile.
And, you know, Animal Planet is monetizing this thing, too, because now there are enough people out there with smart TVs, you know, big HD TVs that either can tune this stuff themselves or have like a Roku or Apple TV or something. So they have advertising that's designed for you to see these webcams in all their HD glory on a TV set.
Well, and not to get too professorish about it, but some of these, you know, reef cam, I'd like to see this reef cam in 5 years. There's an environmental story tucked in here, not with all of these, but with some of them. And so, yes, they're fun. Yes, I find them relaxing and humorous, as Charles does. But maybe long term, there's some news value here as well.
Yeah. What are they doing with all those kittens?
I don't know, but I had to say, when I tuned into the reef cam, I wanted to watch the kitten cam and the penguin cam and
watch
the cockroach
cam.
I spent a lot of time looking at those. Well, I'm sorry to say we don't have any more time this week for our program, so thanks for listening and watching. There's more background information on today's topics, if you'd like, on our Links blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. You can also go there if you'd like to replay the audio or the video of the show. You can also leave us comments there, your questions or suggestions for topics, or if you'd like, you can send them via email to views@kbia.org. RJI's Travis McMillan directs our show each week. KBIA's Pat Akers handles the audio. I'm Mike McKean. Lee is going to be at the helm next Wednesday, so join her and Charles for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.